Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Hello everyone, welcome and thanks for listening to the latest installment of Bardo's Blatherings, the podcast where Mary Craig and I have a good old natter about the curious, the shadowy and the often magical history of the Scottish Borderlands. Mary, today, a little bit of a change to our normal style, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Usually what happens is while I'm out, before we meet to record a podcast episode, I'm out in the morning with young Cassie, or old Cassie, as you know, is, and I have a good old think about something that's on my mind.
Yeah.
And then I throw that topic at you, and to use the business jargon, we take a deeper dive into that particular topic.
Indeed we do.
But today, we had already decided to talk about the Burgundians.
Yes.
Now, that is interesting. So today's topic is the Burgundians. Earlier this morning, I was in the local cafe with Cassie for a little treat. And the three guys in there said, ah, Mary's coming today. You're going to record a podcast. What are you going to talk about? And I said, the Burgundians.
Right.
And they went, Burgundy. Oh, France and wine.
Quite right, too, yes.
And I thought, well, maybe that's what most people associate with Burgundy and the House of Burgundy.
Yeah. Yeah.
So as a starting point, I think what we need to do is accept that the story may be a little bit wider than France and wine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Slightly.
And we'll come to that, but let me try and take you from the Burgundians to the Scottish borders, if I can, with my limited knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
If we look at, I guess, the, and correct me when I do go wrong, but if we look at the 14 and 1500s, so a couple of hundred years building up to the union of the crowns of Scotland and England in 1603, that's one date I do remember. So that couple of hundred years, there's quite an interesting contrast between Scotland and its relationship with its closest neighbour and its close neighbours, i.e. the Low Countries and France. And on the one hand, the relationship between Scotland and England in the 14 and 1500s is, how would we put that? There's a lot of animosity, a lot of wrangling, a lot of division.
They're not happy neighbours.
They're no getting on.
No.
But in contrast, in a sense, during that very same time, Scotland is forming kind of ad hoc and shifting alliances with France and the Low Countries.
Yes, yes.
There's marriage within the royal houses. Mm-hmm. There's trading exchanges. There are cultural and social exchanges. And if we dive a bit deeper, to use that jargon again, one of the trading things that I'm aware of is the fact that Scottish wool was traded into the Low Countries.
Absolutely, at a premium. Scottish wool was prized.
And I think that neatly brings us to the Scottish borders.
Indeed, yes. Absolutely. And here's Cassie is coming in to join us in the
Cassie.
Podcast.
Now here she's
coming through. So if anybody hears little feet in the back, there, little pause, it's her Cassie who's decided that she wants to join in the podcast.
Did I say the word treat there? I don't
you
think
did,
so.
You did. You did. And now here's Cassie to come and learn all about the Burgundians. Eh, Cassie?
I said treaty and she had treat.
Exactly. She's not daft.
Dog language is incredible.
Isn't it just?
Hello, Cassie. Hello, sweetheart.
She's decided
anyway,
to join us.
Sorry, Mary.
That's fine.
Cassie has come to interrupt us as usual.
Good for her.
So I guess on the one hand, there's between Scotland and the Low Countries, this is fellowship, friendship, federation. Yet with England, the closest neighbour, there's all sorts of division going on.
Yes, of course.
Now, I guess the Burgundians played a big part in this. So, my first question would be, what's the origin story?
Aha.
It's not just France and wine, is it?
No, it's absolutely not. Where did the Burgundians come from?
Yeah.
Now, how long have we got in the podcast? We could be here for years. There are a couple of series as to where the Burgundians originally came from.
Aha, right, right.
So, there was an island off Denmark. Well, there are lots of islands off Denmark.
Oh, yeah.
One which had a name, Burgan, or something Burgan. Along those lines.
Yeah,
so it
yeah.
might be that they hailed from there, or that might just be a happy coincidence.
Coincidence, yeah, yeah.
It's slightly more likely that they are like the Huns. They're one of the steppe tribes that came across.
Yeah, yeah.
But we first find note of them at the fall of the Roman Empire in the West, where they are one of the tribes that crosses the Rhine.
Oh, it's the Rhineland?
Yes.
Oh, right, right.
So they pitch up, and of course, when the fall of the Roman Empire happens, there's all sorts of tribes and clans, and everybody's scrambling to see what can happen when you get a power vacuum.
Mm, yeah, yeah.
The Catholic Church steps into the structures of the Roman Empire, if you like, but lots of people are jockeying for position, and yeah. the Burgundians are there with the rest. So we sort of have a bit of a note about him. He's mentioned; they're mentioned in Julius Caesar's Gallic Wars, these sorts of things.
Ah,
but
right.
they're one of the small tribes. Nobody's really bothered about them.
Yeah, yeah.
So then we sort of lose track of them for 200 or 300 years. And then they reappear round about the 9th, 10th century.
Uh-huh.
And they are settled somewhere sort of in between France and what is now Germany. They're in the south of France, maybe a little bit into Switzerland, maybe a little bit into the northern Italian states. But they've also got lands up in the Low Countries, Luxembourg, Belgium, Netherlands.
Yeah.
So they've got sort of two or three bits and pieces of land that don't all fit together. Then for the next couple of hundred years, there's a lot of fighting going on in Europe. Various different people are fighting each other, usually their family members, which is always fun.
Oh,
and you've got the France is rising, and then you've got Charlemagne coming up. You've got countries
yeah.
like Lotharingia. There's a fantastic book, if anybody wants to read a book, by a chap called Norman Davis, and it's called Vanished Kingdoms.
Mm.
And it is a book yeah. all about all of these small kingdoms that existed in Europe that we don't hear about anymore. So it's
yeah.
a great wee book.
Yeah.
So the Burgundians sort of pitch up here and there and here and there and here and there. And then they sort of settle in the early Middle Ages, where they have got a stretch of land from northern France down quite a slim corridor to southern France, bit of Switzerland, and the top of the Italian states.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which isn't a huge amount of land, but is strategically quite important bit of land. Thank mm-hmm. you very much.
Yeah.
Because it means that they can trade from northern to southern Europe. And if you can trade from southern Europe, then you can trade across to the great entrepot Constantinople,
uh-huh.
which is fantastic. So although they're not big and they're not powerful, they're strategically well placed. There are various items of trade that are important.
Yeah.
One is amber, and they pick up on that, a little bit of the amber trade that's coming down through what would now be the Czech Republic and Moravia,
yeah.
Bohemia.
Yeah.
But the other one is wool. Because the vast majority of people wear wool in Europe because it's cold.
It's a wee
even
bit
in
cold.
The summer.
Yeah.
It's cold, we wear wool. And because of the way Burgundy lay, you've got the weavers up in the north
yep.
and you've got the trade down in the south. So that is why Burgundy becomes extremely rich. The French don't like them because they're rich. The German states don't like them because they're rich. The French like them because they're in the way of the German states, and the Germans like them because they're in the way of France.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's fun and games. The Burgundians are not very militarily aggressive, but because they've got as much money as they can, what they do is they show off their wealth. So Burgundian wine and jewels and clothing, sumptuous clothing. They're one of the first countries that actually introduces sumptuary laws whereby you can only wear certain clothes depending on what rank you're in. They also corner the market in providing the cloth for cardinals' capes and for the Pope. And so that means they are blessed by God. So they basically parade up and down Europe, sort of sticking two fingers up to France and the German state, saying, we're rich and God loves us. So
and they have an early handle on product diversification, clearly.
Absolutely. By about the 13th, 14th centuries, they are really cornering the market. Now, we're still in mercantilism at that point, but they have a look around and they realise that they could go to England for wool. And they do. They get quite a bit of wool from England. But they really like Borders wool. And the reason they really like Borders wool is because the undercoat of Borders sheep wool, I know nothing about sheep, they've got a leg in each corner, that's about it, is quite soft and warm. And the outer layer is slightly waterproof. So it's really good quality. Now that is similar to sheep in places like Northumberland and Cumbria and Yorkshire, obviously. But Scotland isn't an aggressive country at that point. England is. And so they are happier to come and trade in the Borders than they are to go and trade in England. So that's why there's a really, really strong connection. The other connection is the fact that a lot of the sheep in the Borders comes from the abbeys, and the abbeys, of course, are originally of French descent. So that allows the Burgundians to trade with holy houses, which is good, that gets you in with God, but actually trade with French houses, so that stops the French from attacking you because you're trading with them, and that is a snub to the German states. So politically you're getting that, economically you're getting this, and you're in with God. So the Burgundians really know what they're doing. So that's why there's a really strong Borders connection.
So though small in empirical terms, they're really influential in the geopolitics
hugely,
of the time.
Hugely influential. Now, France has decided that it wants to take over Burgundy by about the 14th, 15th century. Because basically they're rich. they just want their money. France has also got things like there's also the Kingdom of Navarre in the south of France. France then is not France.
It's not France
today. But we're talking about France. And they decide that they want to take this on. And they try and push the Burgundians. And the Burgundians realise militarily they can't really do it. So what they do is they just sort of shout to the Pope and say, oh, the French are picking on us. And the French have to back down. As a further snub to the French, Philip III of Burgundy, who's the Duke of Burgundy, decides, and he calls himself Philip the Good, he decides...
Oh, is that the person who, from my memory of history lesson, Philip the Good?
Philip the Good.
Is he not married into the Scottish royals?
He is married to a Stuart lassie, and I can't remember her name. I think it's a Mary. Yes.
Always a Mary.
But he decides to really annoy the French, because what's been happening recently is in France, there have been troubadours and medieval stuff and, you know, chivalric knights and all these sorts of things. And Philip decides that he's going to have a chivalric order of his own, and he invents the Order of the Golden Fleece.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch. And organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Oh, I know what's coming now. That's why I wanted to talk about the Burgundians, because variously, when I popped into the archive to see you, and we talked about a whole range of different things, the coming of the railways, the rise of the mills, and one day when Jessica was in, she had brought this teasing, carding, this old piece of equipment, and we were talking about yarns and so on.
Right,
and
yeah.
Eventually you popped the word Burgundian into the conversation, so I thought, let's do an episode on this, because there's a lot to this story.
Yeah.
So there's a heraldic order now.
So it's a chivalric order. And it's the order of the Golden Fleece. And if you think of like a mayor's chain of office sort of type thing.
Yeah.
In the centre of that chain, there hangs a border's sheep. A golden border sheep to this day. And it is the second highest chivalric order in France. The Order of the Golden Fleece.
So that's...
And it directly comes from those Burgundian... Dukes.
Kind of like the Order of the Thistle in UK terms, in a sense.
Yes, or the Order of the Garter. Yep. Yes, it is the second highest. And it is still given to the Dukes of Burgundy,
really?
Who still exist in France today. And as I say, you can see it, and it's a golden, it's a ram hanging from this chain of office, and it's golden.
Oh, I shall check that out. That's a really concrete manifestation of the link between the Houses of Burgundy and Scotland.
Mm. And, of course, it moves forward as France and Burgundy fight each other, and basically Burgundy sort of dissolves away, if you like.
Yeah.
So you end up with bits of Burgundy getting absorbed into the Low Countries and bit getting absorbed into France
into
and some
France.
Into the German states and whatever. That wool trade continues. Which allows people to make a huge amount of money.
Yeah.
And the only reason the wool trade fell away, and part of the reason why the Burgundians were really broken, was the Reformation. Because, of course, the Reformation changes, and instead of having cardinals, you've got sort of, you know, ministers and priests and vicars, and you don't have cardinal capes. So you don't need that wool trade.
So back to sackcloth.
Yeah. You know, so you don't have the... And one of the other elements of border sheep wool is the fact that apparently it takes and holds a dye really, really well.
Ah, right.
One of the reasons why cardinals' capes are sort of a purpley red is, again, coming back to the Roman Empire, because you have the imperial purple.
Imperial purple, yeah.
And so you have this purpley red colour, which nobody in ordinary life at that time was wearing. And again, the folks up in the Low Countries were really good at dyeing this wool and getting the wool to, because it's easy, it's quite easy to dye wool. It's getting the dye to stay, obviously.
Yeah.
And they had perfected a lot of these techniques that, again, they kept to themselves for a long time before, as I say, the Reformation sort of paid to that.
Yeah.
So that was a bit of a breach there, which was a shame that breach went. But the Burgundians were strong in that there were a lot of Burgundian gentlemen who came across the Scottish borders and married some border lasses. And there were a fair few border boys that went across to live and work in the Burgundian courts. When the abbeys were being built a little bit earlier, master masons would get local lads from the borders to come and work for
them. That rings a bit of a bell for me,
And then they would go across...
Yeah.
Into the Burgundian court. So you have all of these sorts of movements of people between the borders and between Burgundy, you have mentions within Burgundian court records of Scotchmen who are good workers.
Mm-hmm.
So they mention Scotland, they talk about the borders. Admittedly, the border to them is, as always, a bit of a movable feast.
Yeah.
So sometimes they're talking about areas that it's obviously over the border into England. But it's most definitely borderland mm-hmm. that they are most enthralled to with this great wool trade that made the borders as rich as it was at that time.
Forever the debatable lands in yes. terms of definition.
Yes. Well, there was also the fact that the Burgundians, because of the old alliance, being between Scotland and France, so yeah. that if England ever annoyed one of them, the other would come in and help out.
Yeah.
Burgundy wants to help Scotland, but wants to annoy France and likes annoying England. It's like 10-year-old boys in the playground. It really is, folks. Medieval Europe is a hoot and a half. It's
yeah.
just, I'm in your gang. You're yeah. not in my gang. Right. I'm not playing football with you today. It's just basically
now
that.
How do we help Scotland, but at the same time annoy France?
Annoy France.
Who wants to help Scotland?
And annoy England, you see. Yep. So you would get the Burgundians, and because they weren't a great military nation, what they did was they did propaganda. And they did, you know, like this. Fake news, misinformation.
Uh-huh.
If you want some misinformation, that's it. So the Burgundians would send spies into the French courts where they would talk a lot of rubbish about England and how England were doing this and doing that and doing the next thing. So France and England would end up having a spat about something, at which point Scotland would get involved to go in and annoy England through its back door, at which point Burgundy would say, oh, well done, the Scots, while sniggering on the sidelines, no doubt. So there was a lot of that going on, a lot of spies from Burgundy. And going back to your three colleagues in the cafe this morning, Burgundian wine. The labels on Burgundian wine bottles were used to send secret messages.
Oh, this is great.
Some of the messages were to you know, their own people or whatever, but a lot yeah. of it was misinformation because it was very much like, you know, like codes and things.
Uh-huh.
They knew that the French knew they were up to something.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would deliberately put misinformation on the wine labels, knowing that the French were going to be reading those messages. And they just made as much mischief as they could. They also would sort of sew notes inside cloth that were absolute nonsense, yeah, complete yeah. and utter rubbish,
mm-hmm.
knowing that the cloth would be checked as it went through different areas and different ports. So they were basically mischief making.
Mm-hmm.
Whilst
and
they could.
They're sending people to the French court to create mischief.
Well, yes, because you know, you've got yeah. traders moving anyway, and they know that, you know, the traders yeah, are going to yeah. get stopped by the French,
yeah.
so you can just innocently put a message on there. And it can be gobbledygook, it can be absolute nothing, but because the French are busy arguing with the English and what's going on here and what's going on there, and because at that time Scotland was this small, insignificant, titchy little corner on the edge of Europe, nobody was really bothering with it. So it meant if you traded with Scotland, nobody cared. You know, if you were trading
yeah,
with a big
yeah.
nation, if you're trading with the Rhineland, if you're trading with Constantinople, if you're trading with Spain, people are bothered by that. That's a big country. What are you doing? Why have you got trade links? You get tiddly little trade links with Scottish sheep. So what? Nobody cares. So it meant that the traders could move quite freely, but their goods could be seized and checked. So it allowed the Burgundians a way of passing misinformation in probably the most innocent of terms.
So maybe the government in Westminster have got something up the sleeve there, because post-Brexit, they're coming up with a lot of Mickey Mouse trade agreements with small countries, but maybe there's
a double motive.
Maybe there's a plan behind it.
Maybe there is a plan there.
Well, they've got a plan and Labour has not.
Because I think it's quite interesting that if you look to when Burgundy sort of dissolves away, and you're left with the countries that we know of, the Low Countries. I mean, Scotland has always had strong trading links
yeah, yeah.
with those Low Countries. Yeah. Now, not so much with southern France and the Italian states and Switzerland, but certainly the Low Countries, the remnants of Burgundy, there are still those trading links. There are still, and what's interesting is that if you move into the 17th century, which is my favourite century, if you look at it, Scotland is trading with, not in a big scale, but it's trading quite well with the Low Countries, with the Baltic States, with Scandinavia, and we're generally getting along with most people. England are also trading, but during that entire period, they decide to have a punch-up with the Dutch.
There's a power grab going on,
You know, it's almost as if, you know, they've already colonised, they've started colonising places like India, and yet they're still being aggressive. They're still, I don't know if it goes back to the original Plantagenet family of the English and the French always fighting each other and always vying for power, but they seem to spend more time fighting than they did trading, where in Scotland and certainly in the borders, they certainly did more trading than fighting. Again, possibly because we're too little to fight, I don't know, or simply because we're a smallish country. The Netherlands, the Low Countries were small countries, and we thought, well, let's just trade with each other instead of wasting our time fighting.
You've sparked my interest there, because when we lived in Brussels, visiting places like Bruges, I do recall these little references to trade now, you know, looking at some of the art in some of the galleries and things like that. It does ring a bell in terms of that volume of trading, though small, that was going on between Scotland and the Low Countries.
It was just going on. People were just getting on with trade, because Scotland is a small country. It's a difficult country to farm because we've got exciting things like, you know, Glencoe in the middle of it. the weather's not good. We don't have a long growing season. Obviously, you can live. You can live on porridge and neeps and water, but it's not very exciting. Again, the Netherlands is a small country. Half of it's underwater. Seriously, half of it's underwater. So if you're a small country, it's really, you know, you can survive. But if you want to do more than survive, you need a trading partner. So you find another small country to trade with. So you have countries like Scotland and the Netherlands and Denmark. These little countries trading with each other. Whereas England decides it's going to have a punch up with Sweden. A huge, big military... Why would you pick on Sweden at that time? It's a big, aggressive military nation. You know, it's very bizarre, those different approaches. The smaller countries, as I say, tended... It's a generalisation, but they do tend to trade more than fight, and the bigger countries tend to fight more than trade, or they fight to trade. To enable them to trade is perhaps a better way to do it.
Let's not go to Darien, but I think... I'm thinking about, you know, just building on what you're saying. Let's, instead of fighting, let's use marriage. Let's bring royal houses together, in a sense.
All of the royal houses in Europe, across Europe, were all intermarried. But it didn't matter, because if you're a lassie, your job is to get married and have babies. Mm-hmm. The minute you get married, it doesn't matter where you're from, you are now in the household that you are in. So you have to have loyalty to that household. Yeah. So if you're from Scotland and you marry into England or France or one of the German states or whatever, your loyalty is then not to your birth country. It's to the country of the family that you have married into.
Yeah. So all those alliances don't always work. To a podcast we did quite recently, this was Henry VIII's idea. That, you know, we talked about the rough wooing. Was to get Mary, Queen of Scots, in to his household and actually push that button.
Yes, exactly. Do what you can.
Power move, in a sense.
But I mean, if you look at things like the wool trade and why it was so important, there was actually a murder in Stow in the 12th century, which is directly related to the wool trade. Melrose Abbey, a Cistercian order.
Cistercians,
had, at its height at the end of the 12th century, something like 20,000 sheep. Massive sheep, okay? And their pasture land went quite the way up north and hit on the pasture land of Weedale. So the Abbot of Melrose wants his sheep to have the best pasture land, and the Gala Valley is a very lush green valley. Yeah. So he wants his sheep in here. The Vicar of Weedale does not want said abbot's sheep in his area. And there's a standoff. And at one point, the abbot, and I'm going to get his name right, Ernald, who's the abbot of Melrose, comes up to Stourwedale with a band of men, and there is a pitched battle between the monks of Melrose and the clerics of Stow, and one of the clerics of Stow is murdered over sheep, over pasture. This has to go all the way to the Pope because, well, you're not allowed to murder each other. You're certainly not allowed to murder clerics.
And this is at the hands of Ernald the No Very Nice,
exactly.
As he should be known.
Exactly.
Wow.
The Vicar of Weedale obviously writes to the Pope and says, "Oi, big bad Abbot of Melrose has just murdered one of my men." And Ernald writes to the Pope and says, "Oi, they're not letting me pasture my sheep." And the Pope's sitting there thinking, what do I do now?
Yeah.
Because I've got a murder that I need to deal with, but I've got the wool trade that I need to keep on going. I don't want to tick off the Burgundians, because at this point the Pope is having an argument with France, because the Pope and France are arguing. So he doesn't want to annoy anybody there. So he's got the politics of annoying France. He's got the politics of Burgundy shouting, don't upset our wool trade, thank you very much.
Yep.
You've got a murder ongoing. You've got everybody oohing and eyeing about the fact that there's a murder. Several of the other abbeys side with Stow of Weedale, not because they particularly like Stow of Weedale, but it's one in the nose for the Abbot of Melrose. The Abbot of Melrose, he writes to the King of France and says, they're all picking on me. It's a complete and utter mess and takes about 150 years to resolve its way through the papal courts before Ernold, who by this time was dead, obviously, was excommunicated for being a bad boy. During all of this, the Burgundians are stuck because the Burgundians were buying wool from Melrose. They don't want to buy wool from Melrose now because, well, you've got a murderer. And that's a French house. It's a French Cistercian house in Melrose.
Yeah, yeah.
So Burgundy are saying, we don't want to buy wool from you. And they actually switch away from Melrose for a good 20 years and buy their wool elsewhere in the borders because of that murder that took place in Little Stow, which is tiny.
Mm. Wow. Of course, they didn't have the referendum in those days. But the Burgundians, according to what you said earlier, were master propagandists.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. And they made sure that everybody knew about this murder. I mean, this murder, I've only found one reference to that murder in the Scottish Exchequer Rolls. Mm. If you go to the Exchequer Rolls in France, there's tons and tons and tons of, and it's all written by the Burgundians. Oh, the big bad French did a murder. Oh, it's terrible they're murdering Scots people. Oh, look what they're doing. Oh, they're unholy. They should be excommunicated. Oh, it's awful. It's wicked. It's terrible. Because as far as they're concerned, I mean, they didn't, I think, really care about the chap in, the poor chap in Stow that got murdered, but it was a chance to give the French a bloody nose and go on and on and on and on about that fact. Of course, the English join in because they say, oh, goody, because somebody's having a go at France, we'll have a go at France. The minute they do that, the Burgundians stop. The Burgundians go, oh, no.
Yeah.
No, 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 if you're joining in the bullying, we're not doing the bullying anymore.
Yeah.
So they withdraw from it. So that you can read it through the archives in the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris. My apologies for my French pronunciation there. And it reads and reads and reads, and it's really, you know, the Burgundians are going on and on and on and on. And then there's a report in from the English court, and the minute that happens,
and
the Burgundians
stops.
Just stop.
Yeah.
That stops the Burgundians, because now we're not having that. You know, the fighting that goes on. And then, of course, the Burgundians then go back to supporting the Pope and saying things like, oh, well, of course, it must be really difficult for you. And how do you sort out this little problem? And in the meantime, where else can we buy our borders wool from? Because we're not buying from Melrose. But eventually they do go back because the Melrose, it's just too big.
It's too big.
It's just too big for them to ignore.
I'm being flippant, but seems to me the Burgundians would have got Brexit done a hell of a lot quicker than the others did.
What I find surprising about the Burgundians and disappointing is the fact that they dissolve away as a political entity.
Yeah, yeah.
Simply because France are just too big and the German states are too big for them. Because they sound like a hoot and a half to me. Although there is a bit of a split between the Burgundians in the north and the Burgundians in the south.
There were two houses at one time,
And that's really where it splits. And of course they have all of their internal arguments and fighting. And of course the wool that lands in the Low Countries, that's bought by Burgundy, and then it's processed, and then it's sold by the southern part of Burgundy. And of course, you then end up with arguments as to how much money is going where. And so it's sort of that pulls the two geographical parts of Burgundy apart. That's... and allows France, of course, to push and shove and push and shove, as always happens.
The connectivity is, for me, fascinating. This is my issue with the internet. It's a little bit too linear in the way it deals with things. But as you're talking there, I realise that, you know, we did the Jarl, the battle between the two Romani groups, for example.
Yes, yeah, we did, yeah.
Empires, big or small, crumble from within. And it's usually that division between north and south. You know, we often talk about north and south rather than east and west.
Yes.
It's fascinating, that whole story. We've pulled together, sheep, threads, I hate this. A lot of things have come together. And I wanted to do this today because when we've just talked casually about things, the Burgundians have cropped up so often without any real context for them. They were clearly very, very influential. Before we do finish, if we haven't been rambling on for too long, we've talked about trading exchange. We've talked about marriages within houses. What cultural /social impact would the Burgundians have had on this part of the world?
Well, fashion, would you believe?
Well, fashion,
fashion is massive. And outward fashion, outward displays of fashion, because what I find fascinating is that if, I'm going to jump about here, but if you go into the Golden Age in the Netherlands, if anybody goes to the Netherlands today, if you look at some of the older houses, a lot of the older houses and some of the more modern houses, people don't have curtains in the living rooms.
Exactly that.
Because they got very rich very, very quickly. And the Dutch churches were worried that people were frivolously spending all this money. And so what you did was you didn't have curtains in your living room windows so people could look in and see that you were still living a sober life. Go back a couple of centuries when they were part of Burgundy. The ostentatious display.
It was display,
It was display. And that's what you still get. You look at the number of huge, big houses there are in the borders for absolutely no flipping good reason whatsoever. But I've got money, I'm going to have a big house.
On the hill.
You know, so that everybody can see how rich I am and how well off I am. That display of wealth, if you look at the borough towns within the borders, you look at the display, you look at the medieval display there is. It's showing off the performance, the theatricality of the common ridings. Now, you could quite easily have common ridings whereby you've got a couple of dozen lads on the back of horses, riding the bounds, and they go for a drink in the pub afterwards. It's an entire season of processions and displays and flags and clothing, and every town in the borders has got bunting up, and every town in the borders has its colours. And then you go to the next town over, and you have the dipping of the roses, and this is a cornet, and that's a braw lad, and all these, and that's coming. That ostentatious display is coming, I would say, from that wealth of the Burgundians, because there are plenty of places around Europe where there are ceremonies and rituals and events. But that sense of display.
But they're usually based on nature or something other than ostentation.
Well, I mean, if you think of the clothing, it's the fact that every single town in the borders has its different colours. And you see the parade of the braw lad or whoever it is, and they are ostentatiously clean. And then everybody who comes to watch it is wearing certain clothing. You get dressed up to go and see the parade, even if you're not on horseback. You know,
and that's the language trap for people like you and I, because we'll say braw lad and someone will get in touch and say, no, that's only Gaussian.
That's the cornet or something, or whatever, or cornet, and that's absolutely fine, but it's the display of it. It's the fact that you're showing off your wealth. Because as I say, you could have quite easily have a couple of dozen lads riding around on horses, and you would make a day out of it. But it's a whole season, and it's the display element. It's showing things off. Yeah. It's this, you know, there are, that's the sort of thing. And also fine wines, fine clothing, fine dining. Fine.
Yeah.
And especially clothing in the Borders. Again, the Borders could have quite easily produced cloth at a basic level, but it didn't. It produced massive cloth at a really good level.
Yeah.
So that's why, you know, that's why it's really important to see that. And fine wine and fine dining.
Yeah.
You know, people think of Scotland and we don't think of wine drinking, and yet there was a lot of wine drinking.
That's a collocation that I've just made up. Burgundian ostentation. That sounds
very good.
Yes. Mary, thanks a lot. We've achieved, I think, at least two things there. We've highlighted the Burgundians, which was very necessary, I feel, in my education. And we've actually pulled together a lot of references to previous podcasts here where the jigsaw starts to fit. And I think finally, what I take away from this is there's nothing much new under the sun, and that's what's really interesting about history.
Indeed.
I guess.
Trade is the thing in Europe, and what we will do on our website is I will try and find myself, I think I've got an image somewhere, of Philip the Good wearing the insignia.
The insignia would be really interesting.
Of the chivalric order of the Golden Fleece. And you were very, very good. You did not mention the film. You did not mention Jason.
Before we finish, I my mind was going to Jason aboard the Argo, but that is a fascinating parallel in a sense, this idea. We've connected that very much.
Because,
it shows
you just how important wool was the way across Europe from the likes of Scandinavia all the way down to the Greek islands.
Excellent. Mary, thank you very much. That was most enlightening there, and we have put the Burgundians on the map.
On the map, indeed.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye for
now. See you next time. Bye for now. Bye.
Nowadays, trends and news cycles change faster than we can blink, but there are some things that withstand the test of time. And if you're looking for a connection to something timeless, and maybe also a glimpse of life at a slower pace, I believe everyone can relate to the very human experiences explored in Jane Austen's novels. And that's where I come in. My name is Alison Larkin. I'm a writer, comedian, and narrator and host of The Jane Austen Podcast with Alison Larkin. I spent a lot of my childhood in the part of England where Jane Austen lived and wrote, and now that I live in the States, nothing gives me a sense of homecoming quite like narrating her books. On this show, you'll listen to award-winning narration. I'll give myself a pat on the back for that. As well as conversations with actors, writers, and other fascinating people who all share a passionate love for Jane Austen. So please, join me as we embark on a wonderful journey through Jane Austen's work. Be sure to listen and subscribe to The Jane Austen Podcast with Alison Larkin, wherever you get your podcasts.